welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenshine, and today we recognize that recent headlines remind us of how violence, whether in our homes or communities or in public life, leaves deep scars. While October is just around the corner and it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, it's a time to face the reality that abuse affects far too many families in North Dakota. We'll talk with Amy Britz and Kayla Jones from the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition about the scope of the problem and the challenges survivors face in rural and tribal communities and the resources available to help. Also today, News Director Dave Thompson and I review this week's news. We'll visit with Annie Beck from the North Dakota Gateway to Science about new outdoor exhibits, including a kid-sized excavator built in partnership with Bobcat. And we'll head to Fargo, where the Tell Downtown's monthly live storytelling event returns tonight with fresh tales and familiar voices. We begin Main Street today by previewing October. It's ahead on our calendars, and it will be Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It's a time to confront the reality that abuse continues to affect far too many families here in North Dakota. Domestic violence doesn't always look the same. It can take the form of physical harm, sexual assault, intimidation, emotional control, financial dependence, or isolation. And while the problem is widespread, its impact can be even more severe in rural communities and on reservations where distance, privacy, and cultural expectations can make it harder for survivors to reach help. Today, we're joined by two guests from the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, Amy Britz. She's the communications coordinator. Amy, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
And Kayla Jones. She's a domestic violence program coordinator. Kayla, welcome back to Main Street.
Excited to be here.
Together, I hope that you can help us understand the scope of domestic violence here in our state, the unique challenges survivors face in urban, rural, and tribal communities, and most importantly, what resources and steps are available for anyone who may be experiencing abuse or know somebody who is. All right, let's set the stage, if we could. What does data tell us about the prevalence of domestic violence in North Dakota? Is the problem getting worse?
So the numbers nationally are, we know that 1 in 4 women and 1 in 10 men will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And in 2024, the domestic violence programs that are in North Dakota reported record numbers of new individuals that were served.
That's not good news.
No, but also it is good news because that means people are coming to the programs and getting help. And so we saw over a 3% increase in domestic violence numbers, and they served over 6,334 new victims of domestic violence just in 2023. And so that's not even including the numbers of people that return for services.
Do we have a feel for, is the problem getting worse in North Dakota?
So what the programs are reporting is that they're not necessarily that things are getting worse, or that the numbers are getting worse, but that we're seeing higher lethality cases. People are coming in saying that they were strangled by their partners, or they were stalked, or their lives were threatened. And so we have great concern over just the severity being increased.
What about the differences between rural North Dakota and urban, if I can use that in air quotes, parts of our state?
So typically we see higher numbers in urban communities, but we know that domestic violence is more prevalent and often more severe in rural and isolated areas. It's just the challenges for victims living in rural areas versus urban parts, they're different. And so like some of the barriers that people living in rural communities, they have that small town stigma, or like everyone knows someone, or they see Jane's car at the domestic violence center. What is Jane doing there? And that just that isolation. And they might not even know what resources are available in their community if they are experiencing domestic violence.
And just to add to that, in urban parts of the state, again, urban in air quotes, we see more services available. There might be, if you're in Fargo or Bismarck, there might be a mental health provider there. There might be a domestic violence program there. There might be a separate organization that provides safe shelter. In a rural community, there might be none of that. You might have to travel 45 minutes to the nearest domestic violence program to get help. And that might not be an option for someone. Maybe they don't have time off of work to do that travel, or they don't have a safe means of transportation to do that travel. So there's just so many barriers that rural communities face that urban areas may not.
In my intro, I talked about the different types of violence or assault. Some of them are familiar, some of them aren't, but certainly I think we're all aware of physical and sexual violence. How might physical intimidation escalate before help is sought here in our state? What happens?
So like specifically, like in rural communities, we know that homes can be miles apart. And so neighbors might not, like oftentimes we see neighbors as being like that intervention piece. And so when they're miles away, they you might see that intervention piece missing and not reporting or calling 911 that something's happening. But there's also that mentality of like, mind your own business that's deeply ingrained in rural or isolated communities. And so that seclusion gives abusers more opportunity to control and intimidate their victims, and without the fear of being seen or caught, whether it's like slamming doors or destroying property out in the open, blocking exits, maybe using weapons to scare rather than to cause actual harm. And because access to help is limited, Amy mentioned earlier about maybe the program is 45 minutes or 2 hours away, and some programs, they don't have a shelter within their program, so they might need to go to a different community altogether. And then even lack of cell phone signal is another thing people experience. I think we've kind of closed the gap on that, but I know that there's still places out there that still is a thing. And then unfortunately, law enforcement, they might be short-staffed. And then if you're on one side, like McKenzie County is one of our largest counties in our state. And if you're on one side of McKenzie County and you got to get to the other, on a good day, that could take 45 minutes. And then we talk about North Dakota winter, a response time could be an hour and a half, 2 hours away. And so just how dangerous that could be for somebody that's experiencing violence.
I'm going to ask you what we should do in that moment in just a moment, but I want to extend the conversation to our reservation communities that we have in the state. Are there other barriers that impact a survivor's ability to report physical or sexual abuse?
So on reservations, we often see, as we see in rural communities, there might be a shortage in helpers. Law enforcement, we have constant job openings. And so that affects response time. And then also that stigma lives there too. You know everybody that's in your community. The law enforcement officer can be your cousin that's responding, or worse, your abuser's cousin that's going to respond. And if it's the abuser's cousin, it could potentially affect their response to what happened to you.
So what should be done? This is not just a problem for women, as we learned in the open. It's also a problem for men. Kayla, you gave us those statistics. This is happening. It's happened to me now. I'm in a rural place. What should I do?
So part of what domestic violence programs do in our state is they work with their community partners, which include like law enforcement and the state's attorney's office. And they try to come up with like an agreement on how they're going to respond to domestic violence. And so some of them are established and some of them are in the works on how they want to respond to violence. And so in the meantime, what victims can do is they can contact a domestic violence program to a safety plan with them. And I always like to say that victims are the experts on their lives and on their safety. And so an advocate will work with a victim to help them determine the best way to stay safe in their current situation, and whether that's they're going to stay living with an abuser at home, or if they're contemplating leaving, they can talk with an advocate on how to do that safely and get all the ducks in a row to be able to do that safely and then to be able to stay away if that's what they want.
And what should I search for if I need that number to contact now? Or is 911 my option?
So if you are in an emergency, in an immediate unsafe situation, call 911. But if you are in a safe situation, you are not in an emergency, you are not in immediate danger, you can find a local domestic violence program on our website. That is NDDS. And there's a tab that says Find Help. If you click Find Help, it will bring you to a page with a full map of the state of North Dakota. And that shows you where the 18 domestic violence programs are across the state, and you can find the one that is nearest to you, or you can contact really any program. If you are uncomfortable for whatever reason of going to your local program, we've talked about how, you know, sometimes everyone knows everyone in a community. So you can really go to any domestic violence program across the state. Each program has a phone number that is on our website. So you can contact whichever program is nearest to you or whichever program you would like to work with. And they can help you, like Kayla mentioned, navigate your options and figure out the best way to stay safe in your current situation.
Let's move on to intimidation. I thought about this and we see it, I don't want to say normalized, but certainly in Hollywood, right? Where we're in the rural place and my property's damaged. I'm intimidated when I'm in public, but it happens here. What do you see in the folks that you work with that are really victims of being intimidated here in North Dakota that we need to know about?
Another great question. So in small towns, where everyone knows someone, abusers often use like local norms or like cultural norms around privacy and reputation. And those are powerful tools to keep victims silent. There's often a strong culture of, again, you don't air out your dirty laundry, a belief that family problems should be handled within the family and not brought out into the open. Abusers know this and tend to use it to their advantage. They might say things like, no one will believe you, you'll ruin my reputation and yours. And in communities where image and reputation carry a lot of weight, that kind of threat can be incredibly effective.
Debilitating to me.
Yes, exactly. And victims will often fear being judged or gossiped about and then also as a result be completely isolated. And if the abuser is well known, like if they're like the banker, the loan officer, or the judge, or law enforcement, there's often a pressure to not cause trouble or disrupt your community's harmony. And so survivors are left thinking of.
And to that, do you just say, "Hey, baloney, your life is more important"?
You find a nicer way to say that. Yes, yes, like your life is just as important as theirs. His job is not more important than you dying. Like it's just, or you living, and it's just
the steps in are the same for getting help.
Yes. If you, again, are in immediate danger, please call 911. But if you are in a situation where you are looking to understand your options, whether that be finding safe shelter or finding safe ways to stay in or leave in a relationship, please contact a domestic violence program in North Dakota. A full list of those programs can be found at ND under our tab called Find Help.
And again, we wish that we didn't have this conversation, but I'm glad we are having it. It's important we talk about it. My guests today on Main Street are Amy Britz. She's a communications coordinator for the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition, and Kayla Jones. She is the program's domestic violence program coordinator. All right. We've talked about physical and sexual violence, intimidation, emotional abuse. It's also important. And this is not just limited to the high school senior bullying the new sophomore girl. It's so much more than that across our state. So the question can become cultural expectations and stoicism in rural or indigenous communities mask often coercive emotional abuse. And we see that here in our state, unfortunately.
Yes. Emotional abuse often happens behind closed doors. And so like emotional abuse, that often looks like that constant criticism. We see manipulation and isolation or control that slowly chips away or quickly, or honestly, let's just say chips away at a person's confidence and their sense of self. But if the cultural norm says you don't complain, you handle your own problems, victims may feel like they don't have the language or the permission to share what's happening.
Do community structures like tribal councils or churches reduce or worsen victim isolation in some instances?
So I think it's a very important question because community structures like tribal councils or churches, they can absolutely play like a double role. And when it comes to victim isolation, on one hand, these institutions can be vital sources of support. And in communities where resources are limited, strong tribal council or compassionate pastor. They may help the survivor access shelter or legal help or emotional support. When these leaders take abuse seriously and they believe survivors, they can literally create a pathway to safety. But sadly, sometimes that's not always the case. And in some situations, these same structures can actually worsen a victim's isolation, especially when there's pressure to keep the peace or protect the reputation of the community. Victims may be told to forgive or to stay quiet so the abuser's reputation or their families doesn't suffer. And then in very small communities where these institutions are deeply intertwined in daily life, or speaking out can mean losing access to spiritual guidance or social support or even your cultural identity. So churches and tribal councils absolutely can play a part in the solution, but it can also
protect. We hear often phrases like, she's overreacting. That's just tough love. Do you hear those in your daily experiences here in our state?
Yes. Domestic violence is not simple. It's a very complex issue. So when people minimize the experiences of others, it silences victims. And in the silence, domestic violence will continue to grow. And so we cannot make excuses for an abuser that chooses to hurt their partners or set the stage for young people to think that violence is love. It's just something that happens in a relationship.
When talking about emotional abuse here, I think it's a trickier thing for people to understand. I think we look at physical violence, sexual violence, that's very clear to a lot of people. Those things are wrong. We cannot tolerate it, right? But emotional abuse, that like, you're essentially wearing down a person's spirit. And so I think that's something that's harder to see because it's internal, right? And so it's harder for support people, whether it be someone in a support system, like a pastor in someone's life, or someone's employer, that you can't see that outright. But I think for a survivor, that can hurt just as much as the physical and sexual violence. And so I think, like Kayla mentioned, those support people in a survivor's life are so crucial, because when someone has not only physically hurt you, but also worn you down mentally to a point where you might feel like you're out of options, you don't know what to do next, those support people are so important to be supporters and encouragers and believing that survivor, because, you know, when you have the reverse, then you've got a survivor that not only is experiencing abuse, but has no support from the people that are supposed to be there structurally to support them. So all of that is to say, please do not dismiss emotional abuse as something as important as physical or sexual violence, because I can at least say for myself, I would say it's equally as important.
Yeah. And in my experience, when I worked with victims, when I was an advocate that worked with victims, victims often reported that it was the emotional abuse that caused the most hurt to them.
Deteriorated self-worth.
They're like, my black eye. Yes, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
When I was preparing for this interview, I got to the information about children and it breaks my heart. But you see, in multi-generational households and maybe other households too, how abusers are manipulating, in some cases, children or visitation to exert control. These are young people. How can they have a voice, and is it a problem?
It absolutely is a problem. And we see in households where violence is happening, that children are sometimes used as a vessel of the violence. And we see some children are chosen as the golden child by the abuser, and they're favored over other children that might be in the household. And so we see an abuser, they might encourage the disrespect or violence toward the victim parent. And some abusers will pressure the victim to be the person who works outside the home. And so then the abuser is the primary caregiver to those children, and they use that as a way to keep the victim in the household. And so they'll say, you know, if you leave me, I'm going to get custody of the kids because I've been taking care of them. And so we just see children used in a lot of different ways, and that can be so confusing for kids. Like, one, like, we know that this one parent is really mean to the other parent and hurts the other parent, but they're really nice to me. And so I'm safe. And so, like, how confusing is that one parent B is being hurt, but I'm safe. And so what is the expectation for me? And so, like, what does that do to a child? Or if children are being hurt themselves, like, we know that's a whole other thing for another horrible thing for them to have to put up with, and what that does to them and their self-esteem and their sense of safety. And so we see a lot of kids use other adults in their lives to gain that sense of safety, or cling to that victim parent for to try to have some.
How do you reach out to such a young person who is experiencing this and needs help? How can you help them find you?
So the domestic violence programs across the state do have some programs that are set up to work specifically with children. And so I would say if you or your child is experiencing this kind of abuse, whether, again, it's yourself as a parent or your former or current abusive partner is using children to either hurt you or they are hurting the children themselves, reach out to a domestic violence program near you. Again, those are on our website. It's SVC. There's a tab that says Find Help. Click that and it will bring you to a directory of programs across the state. I know in some areas of the state as well, there are child advocacy programs, but those may not be as accessible. I believe they're only in certain areas, but certainly that is an option as well.
There are other types of abuse. We talk about male privilege, economic abuse in farming communities, I guess. How might control over land or income, how is it used as a form of abuse here in our state?
So in farming communities, control over land or income is often used as a powerful form of abuse. And those resources are often tied directly to survival and independence. And so when one partner controls access to the land or the equipment, or money from the sales of crops, they can control or limit.
And again, this is not just in Hollywood.
Freedom.
These are things that you see.
I would dare say almost every day we have people coming in from rural communities seeking help with these exact issues.
So with financial abuse, we see across the United States, financial abuse is present in about 99% of domestic violence cases. And so financial abuse is when the abusive partner uses money or finances to exert control. And so in North Dakota here, we might see the abusive partner saying, you can't have a job, you cannot go to work. And that's a way for them to control all the money and finances. And then it might make that survivor dependent on that abusive partner. And they might not have the resources to be able to leave that relationship, or they might feel very isolated in that relationship and like they have no choice but to stay there. And so there's also the flip side of that, like Kayla mentioned, where the abusive partner might say that you are the one that has to have the job, and then they might control that victim's finances and not, they might not even allow that victim to have access to the own money, to their own money that they are making. And then because domestic violence isn't one isolated incident, all these things work together, right? So like the financial abuse and using children, then, you know, the abusive partner could be using the money and finances of the victim. And then also on that end, they are the ones staying home and taking care of the children. And so then they could be using that as a way to maintain custody of the children. So many victims aren't experiencing one of these forms of domestic violence alone. A lot of times we see them all tied together, and that's what makes domestic violence such a complex issue. And a lot of times we don't see easy solutions, and that's why the work of domestic violence programs in North Dakota is so essential. So please, please, if you are experiencing domestic violence, help is out there. There are domestic violence programs across the state of North Dakota. If you are looking for someone to help you navigate your options and understand what you can do next, please go to NDDS. There's a button that says Find Help. If you click that button, it will bring you to a map that shows you all the domestic violence programs in North Dakota. You can contact any program, whether it's the one nearest to you or it's somewhere else that you're more comfortable visiting. If you're more comfortable going outside of your community for help, that is an option for you as well. So again, click Find Help and you can find help near you.
I've also wondered about national hotlines or numbers like 988 relative to domestic violence and the types of assaults that we've been considering today.
Yes. And so those resources, they are fantastic resources. You can absolutely contact them. But Craig, what we tend to see with national hotlines is they end up referring down to local resources anyway. So, and this isn't for sure, you know, you might get a different answer, but if you were to call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, they would probably refer you down to a local domestic violence program anyway. So if you have someone in your life that's experiencing domestic violence, you can kind of save them the time and the energy of calling one number and then getting reconnected with someone else and reconnected with someone else by sending them to a local hotline right away. That way they're going directly to a help source that's in their community or in the next community over. And that way it saves them from jumping through several hoops and they can get straight to help.
And the best way to find someone here in the state is the website. Let's have the address again, Amy.
Yes. If you go to NDVC, there's a tab on our website called Find Help. If you click that tab, it will bring you to a map and directory of the certified domestic violence and sexual assault programs in North Dakota. All of their phone numbers and crisis lines are listed on that webpage, and you can contact a program near you to find help.
October's coming up as we mark Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It's a reminder that abuse thrives in silence and that speaking up can save lives. My thanks to Amy Britz and Kayla Jones from the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition for sharing your insights today. Thank you so much for being with us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Thanks for having us.
Ahead today on Main Street, Dave Thompson sorts through this week's headlines. We'll get hands-on at the North Dakota Gateway to Science with a kid-sized excavator that's digging up big lessons, and the Tell returns to Fargo with stories so unpredictable, one musician didn't even bother with clothes. That's still ahead. Stay with us. It's time for our weekly review of the news with our news director here at Prairie Public on this September 11th. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
This is a tough day. We've had a lot of tough things in the news, and certainly it's a day of remembrance as we all remember the events surrounding September 11th, 2001. Boy, I sure do, and it's certainly a day of reflection, Dave.
For sure. I'll never forget it. Back in the day, we had, you know, some television screens in the news area here, and I first got wind something was happening. We had CNN on, and they showed a picture of smoke at the World Trade Center. Didn't know what was going on, then listened to NPR News at the top of the hour, and then soon afterwards, you know, the second plane hit, and the tower collapsed, and you knew that we were being attacked, basically. And that day, I'll never forget it.
I don't think any of us will. But let's go ahead and do our work here, Dave. We're going to review the news here. The Capitol grounds here in North Dakota, they're changing.
They are changing. This has been an amazing development over the last year or so. First off, the new governor's residence was built. Then they built a new laboratory building that's for the new state lab, basically the crime lab. It's a fairly large facility. Then they're adding on to the Heritage Center, where there's going to be that military museum. So there's a lot of construction going on at the Capitol. The oldest building on the Capitol grounds, which is 100 years old, that's the Liberty Memorial Building, is undergoing roof repair and some basement repairs. They need to shore up the foundation because of water damage. So there's been a lot of construction equipment there, a lot of cranes. It looks very different. The green space is still set there, and you can actually have kind of a nature trail and hike through it.
Dave, it's been a good summer for North Dakota's public dinosaur digs. What do you know about that?
Well, what I know is that this is a great program that they have through the Geological Survey. They invite people to come out and help them with their dinosaur digs. Basically, they've got a couple sites around the state. One's near Medora, one's near Bismarck. And that's where they're getting some of the dinosaur bones and where they have recovered a lot of the fossils from there. This year, they added one more, and that was the Pembina Gorge, and they were looking for aquatic species. So they have three events going on during a summer, and very well-attended people like going out there, and they like having them out there because they lend hands and help find some of these fossils.
Approximately 230 folks were able to help. That's
yes.
Awesome. You've written about the, I guess, waning days of road construction season here in North Dakota.
As you see, the orange signs start to come down, but there's still a lot of orange signs up. We're getting toward the end of the season now, but there's going to be a lot of work ahead because there are some major projects. They talked about $400 million in projects and maybe a similar amount next year. Some of the projects, for example, the interchange just in the east side of Bismarck or the improvements going on in Fargo-Moorhead, And in Minot, they've got an interchange issue, and then Grand Forks has a few issues. Some of those projects may carry over until next year, so we'll see a lot of construction going on.
Dave, the Harwood City Council last night gave its final approval for a data center. But boy, the city of Fargo sure plans to continue to pursue adding the site to its city limits.
I know. It's an interesting fight between the two cities, isn't it? You've got Harwood, who's kind of embraced it, and you've got Fargo saying, hey, we can do it too, and they're going to annex the area. And Fargo is saying that they'll be better to provide the city services that the plant needs than Harwood would be, but don't be surprised if this doesn't end up in court.
Dave, what are you and your team working on?
Well, some interesting. I've got somebody who's been a longtime business owner in Bismarck who is going to be retiring after 50 years at the same business, and
wow,
he's going to devote his life to, you know, to charitable causes. And I've got a chance to interview him tomorrow. There'll be a story that will run next week.
I will look forward to that. Dave, Dave Thompson and I, we review the news here in North Dakota and the region each and every Thursday on Main Street. Dave, enjoy the weekend.
Thank you, Craig. You too.
Read all about it. Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story about a little fella.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving home buyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and the Tell, Fargo's monthly live storytelling event, returns to the 4 and 4 Above Side Street Grill and Pub tonight at 7 p.m. To whet your appetite, let's go back to the Tell's last show from last season, which actually wasn't that long ago. The July event featured the season-ending tell-off, a wild card subject round, if you will. Normally, there's a theme, but that night, anything went. That includes one from frequent storyteller Becky Blenkush, whose North Dakota in New York stories we've featured before here on Main Street. Her tales of living in a mob-run neighborhood that was safe, and the time her and her concert-going friends got stuck on the freeway only to be given a lift by the band they were going to see, The Cure, brought smiles and laughter, as this tale of Aussie musicians.
Hello, everybody. So you're going to all hear another story about my time in New York, so I hope you're not getting tired of this. But I moved to New York when I was about 18 years old, and I went to school at NYU, and I studied journalism there. So I got a degree in journalism, and my concentration was on magazines. And the main reason that I did that is because my big love in life is music. And I wanted to get a job, you know, like working for Rolling Stone or something like that, but mainly... My highlight of my journalistic career was I got a couple of pictures used in Spin, and I got a review published in a local magazine there that was called Sounds. But I mostly wrote for like small independent magazines there. But I did get to interview a lot of bands that I really liked and really enjoyed. And a couple of them were from Australia and New Zealand. And my advice to you is never interview Australians, okay? Because Australians, I don't know if any of you, do any of you have Australian friends or know people from Australia? They're very, very irreverent. They're very casual, and they just kind of operate on their own sort of time zone in their own little world. So I'll give you two examples and try to stay within my time limit. The first one is a fellow named Paul Kelly. He's kind of Australia's version of Bob Dylan. He's really known as a songwriter. And he was opening for another band from Australia at a theater in New York called The Beacon. And that holds about between 2,000 and 3,000 people. So, but he was the opening act because he was lesser known. So my sister and my best friend and I were there, and they were setting up their equipment, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to go up and I'm going to ask him if I can set up an interview with him sometime. So he's doing his equipment thing, you know, setting up his guitars and stuff, and I just went up and leaned up on the stage, and I introduced myself and said, you know, I work for this magazine, and, you know, I'd like to do an interview with you sometime if you have time to do it. He goes, okay, let's do it right now. And he walks around to the side of the stage, and he pulls me up the stairs, and he leads me up into the back of the stage. And my sister and my best friend are watching this, but they have no idea what's going on. And I disappear with Paul Kelly into the back of the Beacon Theater, which is like a rabbit warren or a rat's nest or something. And they just see me disappear with him. And I'm gone for like 45 minutes. And there's 3,000 people in the Beacon Theater waiting. And I'm upstairs with Paul Kelly, and he won't stop talking. And I don't have any paper. I don't have a tape recorder. I didn't have any questions prepared because I wasn't expecting him to say, yeah, let's do it right now. And I'm just like, you know, coming up with questions off the top of my head, you know. But luckily I knew a lot about him, so I did have questions to ask him. But he won't stop talking, you know. And it's like the best thing in the world because I'm getting an interview, but it's the worst thing in the world because 3,000 people are waiting out there for the show to start, and he won't shut up, you know? And I'm just like, oh, my God. People are coming in the room, and they're like, Paul, you know, we got to go. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, then we went, and we did this, and we did that. And I'm just like, oh, my God, everyone's going to kill me, you know? So finally, a couple other guys from the band just come in, and they're like, you know, it's like 15 minutes late. We were supposed to be on. You got to go. And they, like, drag him off. And they leave me there, and I'm like, I don't know where I am. You know, I'm upstairs in this theater. I don't know where the stage is in relation to anything else. I'm walking around for like 10 minutes trying to find my way down. I finally run into another person who gets me downstairs, and I come out. I don't have my ticket because my friend was holding on to it. I get back to my seat finally. My sister is crying because she thinks Paul Kelly, who has convict ancestors, took me backstage and, like, you know, killed me or something, you know. So, and I just kind of fudged from memory what I remembered that he said and what we talked about. And the interview did get published, you know. It kind of was just ad-libbed, you know, because I didn't have notes or anything, you know. So that was it. But even worse experience was with this other Australian. His name is Tex Perkins. He's with the band called The Cruel Sea. They played at CBGB's, and he came off stage. This interview was actually set up. He came off stage just like totally sweaty and everything from playing, and he's known for like just being really irreverent and, you know, funny and stuff. And they were traveling in a white van, and we go out in front of CBGB's, and he's talking to me, and he's answering my questions and stuff, and he's like, oh, I'm really hot. And he starts taking off his clothes. And we're standing out on, you know, 3rd Avenue out in front of CBGB's, and he's got the back of the van open, and he strips naked in front of CBGB's. He's just answering the questions like nothing is happening. He takes all his clothes off. You know, I mean, he's completely naked on the streets, and, you know, and everybody in New York is just like, seen it before, you know, big deal, you know, just walking past, and I'm just like, oh, my God, you know, he's really good looking, did I mention that, you know, I'm just like, oh, my God, you know, and like trying to stay focused and stay on track and whatever, and so I get the interview, and I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to take pictures, you know. You know, I guess I'll wait until you get dressed again, you know. And so, yeah, that was really, you know, two of my interviews with Aussies. So you got to be really careful how you handle that. So, yeah, that's kind of my stories about my adventures with Aussies.
That's Becky Blenkush's tale of conducting music interviews with a couple of eccentric characters from down under, only one of whom was clothed. You can catch the tell in person tonight at the 4 and 4. That's just above Side Street Grill in downtown Fargo. And you can find details at the tell's Facebook page.
The Fargo Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 1 from the New World. Performances include Adam Hochstetter's Noir Concerto No. 1 for saxophone and Russ Peterson's Between Two Cultures, September 20th and 21st at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Information at fmsymphony.org.
And And it's Thursday, so our chance again to visit with Annie Beck. She's a STEM educator at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Last week, we talked about many of the upcoming events. We're going to focus on a specific exhibit this week here on Main Street at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Annie, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back.
All right, so many exhibits to choose from. What did you pick for us, and what are you going to paint the picture of for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So this summer, new to us is our Outdoor Explorium. So we are currently developing it and adding different exhibits to our outdoor learning space. And one of the ones that we are the most excited about this summer is our new exhibit that we did in collaboration with Bobcat. We have our very own excavator and dig pit. It's part of a long-term and ongoing partnership we've had with Bobcat. And so just like we have our students do, we went through the engineering design process of what do we want? What are some different ideas? Building prototypes, what's working, what's not working, what we can change. Until now, the final product is a mini excavator on a pedestal. And on that pedestal, there are four wheels. And those four wheels control hydraulics. With electric assist. And each of the wheels controls a different component of the excavator. So you can either do all four yourself, or you can work on it with a group of friends. So, and dig up some pea gravel and learn a little bit more about the engineering process with that.
So we're in the fall. It's still open and available for everyone.
Absolutely. Yep. We don't have a set end date. As long as our beautiful North Dakota fall weather happens, we will be out there.
I've always been fascinated when I drive my little grandson around. He's like a first grader, and it's not the structures, it's the dirt. That's what he wants to, and the excavators and how all that stuff works, and stop the car, grandpa, let's go. And he's just fascinated by those things. So I'm guessing that is an awesome exhibit at the North Dakota Gateway to Science.
Absolutely. Yeah. Who doesn't like digging in the dirt, right? And the one thing that I really like about all of our exhibits are the connections, you know, the connections in this case between Gateway to Science and one of our local industries, Bobcat, connections between our exhibits and real world careers. You know, who hasn't driven around and seen Bobcats working in the community and to get an actual opportunity to see kind of how they work and try it yourself, to see the connection between what we have in our outdoor exhibits and then to come inside and see what exhibits have connections with it and the science behind it. And to see it, what an example of what collaboration and creativity can come up with. So we have in our outdoor exploring in general, we have a number of new things. We have a mix and mess with this kind of an outdoor water table where we're going to have different engineering and science activities with that. We have animal tracks throughout the exhibit on the sidewalk where you can see what different animals walk through the area. We are going to be adding different art and music exhibits. We have a sand pendulum to look at the patterns of motion. And then we also have, of course, we are outdoors. So we have a lot of different plants and wildlife learning as well. We have a large pollinator garden that we partnered with master gardeners from the area to do. And we also have a greenhouse and other raised beds with different planting experiments that our kids that are in our camps and clubs have done.
Annie, what are the hours here in fall for the North Dakota Gateway to Science?
So we are open from 10 to 5 on Mondays through Saturdays. On Wednesdays, we do open an hour early. And Thursdays, we stay open 2 hours later. And then on Sundays, we're open in the afternoon, 1 to 5.
Annie Beck, she's joining us here weekly on Main Street, talking about the great things at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Annie, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You can tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free family event is October 4th and 5th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, fabric artists, jewelry artists, group studios, and more, all demonstrating their work. Peruse the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 11th. During the first half of the 19th century, the United States government sent out expeditions to explore the western portion of the country. Government officials wanted to understand what the nation had acquired in the Louisiana Purchase. These expeditions included surveyors, scientists, and military troops. They also included artists. In the days before photography, the only way to see what expeditions found was through the work of painters who had seen it for themselves. Painting at the time was difficult enough in a studio. It was nearly impossible while trekking through unexplored territory, carrying all the necessary equipment and materials. Albert Bierstadt made his first trip out west in 1859 with Frederick W. Lander's expedition across the plains to the Rocky Mountains. His paintings stunned Eastern viewers with the beauty of the mountains, unlike any landscape they had ever seen. Among Bierstadt's challenges was the fact that he had to mix his own paints. Once mixed, artists saved the paint in a pig's bladder, tied shut with a string. Unfortunately, those bladders didn't travel well and sometimes burst. On this date in 1841, John G. Rand changed all that. An American artist living in London, Rand was frustrated by having to mix and preserve his own paint. He invented a tube made from tin sealed with a screw cap. The paint was pre-mixed and stored in the tubes. It had a long shelf life. The tubes didn't leak, and the cap meant they could be opened and sealed again and again. The tubes were slow to catch on, but painters came to appreciate the convenience. The tubes were lightweight and easy to transport. Frederick Remington's drawing of a Wyoming cowboy, published by Harper's Weekly magazine in 1882, launched his career. He became the most famous painter of the West. Thomas Moran joined an expedition to Yellowstone in 1871. His watercolors were instrumental in influencing the establishment of Yellowstone as America's first national park. Images of the West captivated Americans. The Eastern public was anxious to see for themselves what wonders lay out west. Artists, including James Audubon, George Catlin, and John Singer Sargent, introduced Americans to the wonders of Dakota Territory. Their work encouraged people to move and settle the American West. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. I've just come from the Morning Edition meeting where we were posing questions about the killing of Charlie Kirk. What do his life and death say about political speech, political violence, and the state of this country? We'll try for answers and have an update on the investigation on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street on this 24th anniversary of the events surrounding the terror attacks on September 11th, 2001. This day is a day of reflection, and it reminds us of our ongoing commitment to honor the lives lost, the families forever changed, and the heroes who responded with such courage. We'll be back with you Monday here on Main Street, and we hope you can join us again.